8 of them's already gone. The faith is not very encouraging. Okay. Okay. They took us down last week for copyright infringement, so that's why I had to go back and repost the YouTube version up. It was the time we left here and got over to Tracy's mom's. I was going to pull it up, and she pulled the video up, and it was gone. Copyright. I guess Neil, he come up with it. I guess when I'm preaching, my voice is so angelic. Y'all are laughing. That they think it's, you know, like somebody singing. So I kind of like that, and my angelic voice. Yeah, Pied Piper. But now I disputed it, and they put it back. So, but it had gotten lost in the mire pretty quick. So we're going to be talking about the parables of grace again. We're going to be in Luke 12, and let's see, are we going to get to, we won't be in chapter 13 this time. Remember, Jesus has left Galilee and he's headed towards Jerusalem for his triumphal entry in. So he's given these parables on the way there. That's kind of very important. And I think the last time when we talked about these parables, we'd kind of talked about that rich, I think we ended up with that rich fool about building barns. Yeah. Jesus kind of gives these parabolic utterances along the way. Do you know he's a good storyteller? You know, I got to thinking about this. You know, we go over on the farm, and you know, we need to get back to the art of good storytelling. We really do, because it is a story. And when we get all of our family together, the highlights for me, you know what it is? I mean, you meet everybody, but it's everybody sitting around a fire telling stories. You know? And sometimes those stories are funny. Sometimes they're scary. You know, things that happen to you. And, you know, we've all been included here in this Jesus story. Story, believe it or not, is what connects us in that. Man, I could go down a big, long road right there, but I have discovered some things here, looking at these parables, looking at scriptures. Maybe, you know, I don't know, learning to ask questions, but maybe questions that are there I think, let me go over here into Exodus. This is just a side note. I'm not going to answer this question. I'm just going to accept. Yeah. Y'all didn't know I used to be a rapper, did you? I'm going to ask it. Okay. I'm going to ask a question. Okay. The this is in Genesis, verse 29. Jacob sod pottage. Isn't that a weird way to put it? Jacob sod pottage. What are you doing today? We're going to sod some pottage. Yeah. And Esau came from the field and he was faint. Oh, you just read that verse and, well, here's the question. Why was Esau faint? See, little kids would ask questions like this. We were watching this show the other day, and Tracy and I was watching this little kid, so they're telling a story about a little princess. And they're like, well, it was on a boat. And the little kid's like, well, why were they on a boat? You know, we're like, that's not part of the story. But to him, it's part of the story. Why were they on the boat? Where were they going? So when you get the, and I want you to just see, when you read the scriptures, guys, we just read with stoic faces. Man, there's doorways here. Right here is a doorway, and he's inviting you in to ask you the question, or so that you can come to the table and say, why is Esau all wore out? Does anybody care why Esau's wore out? Why? I mean, a little kid would ask that question, wouldn't he? A little kid's going to ask, well, why is Esau tired? What's he been doing? If you want to find the answer to that, I will tell you this. It's in the book of Jasher. Do y'all know there's a real book of Jasher? Now, it's not in this Bible. They've taken it out, but it's mentioned in this Bible. There's two other books, the book of Enoch and the book of Jasher. Was it not written in the book of Jasher? Well, it's written in the book of Jasher. You'll find out why Esau was faint, why he was wore out. So, I mean, so there's a lot here that's inviting us. So Jesus comes along. He's the master storyteller, and he's inviting us in all the time. I mean, so this... You know, when somebody's telling a story, if it's a good story, man, it ought to be an invitation. You ought to be into the story right there. And I'll share this with you. We didn't even get to our text here, but, you know, I've learned some things like in the scriptures, when it talks about marriage, see, we bring our Western culture to the table when we read the Bible. We bring our Western culture. We sit down and we think that Jesus wrote the Bible to us. He did not write the Bible to us. It's written for us, but it wasn't written to us. When Paul wrote Colossians, he wasn't writing to Americans. He was writing to Colossians. So the language he uses is going to be language that they can understand and tell you. Remember last week we were talking about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and it's language that they could understand. So Paul, sometimes when Paul is writing, and Don and I were talking about this the other day, you know, there was a time in Galatians when Paul writes that Paul was sent to Arabia. Remember that? So you know how we Western Christians kind of think of this. Oh, Paul is out in the deserts in Arabia somewhere, and he's just sitting there like this, you know, and God is just pouring into him. But that's not really true. He was learning, because remember, Paul is a fundamental Jewish zealot. He didn't like Gentiles. He didn't care about Gentile customs. He didn't care about nothing. Build the wall. You Gentiles stay over there. We'll stay over here. Don't bother us. We won't bother you. But now he is so infused with their culture in the book of Acts, he begins to quote their own poets to them. When Paul says, in him we live and move and have our being, he's quoting their own poets to them, something they would have recognized immediately. So Paul is writing to the Colossian church, or to the Corinthian church, and he makes this statement that I would present you as a chaste virgin, right? to Christ. Where does he get this language? You know what we do? We don't go into the story and begin to ask questions. Paul, what do you mean? We just automatically plug in our Western mindset of a virgin, and then boom, we think we figured it out. Or we try to get to, oh, he's talking about your spirit being clean and all of this, you know, crazy stuff that we do with it. You know, I'll share this with you. I won't go down this road, but have you guys ever heard of a Vestal Virgin? Anybody ever heard of that? You guys are just looking at me like I'm crazy. You know, that's kind of one of them I'm inviting you to answer. Yes or no? Vestal Virgin. Nobody's ever heard of a Vestal Virgin? You have? See, that was part of their culture. Do you know that Rome was founded in this manner? Does anybody know how Rome started? I know you're thinking, who cares, right? Does anybody know how Rome started? Does anybody know how America started? You see, history is important, guys. And see, we lose all of this stuff. Rome was started. You remember me been telling you about the scapegoat and cities founded on a murder? Well, Rome was started because two brothers, Romulus, and I can't remember his brother's name, Romulus killed his brother, founded the city of Rome, greatest empire that we've known to man. And they had a lot of customs. So when you read the scriptures, this was customs that everybody knew about. Just like we have the custom of Thanksgiving. You know, Thanksgiving is not celebrated in Canada. You go up there and you start talking about, hey, man, we're taking Thanksgiving off. They're like, what is Thanksgiving? It's our custom. So in Rome, and everybody of the culture would have known this, the king, and this is the way cities were founded. I'm just sharing this with you, okay? Just one little thing. So hopefully when we go back and look at some of these stories, our minds will open up a little bit. So the king was also the priest, and he would set up the hearth. Do y'all know what the hearth is? Come on, man. You guys got to help me out. What's a hearth? Anybody got one at their house? The fireplace. Well, where did this thing come from? It's called a hearth. Now, we'll call it the mantle over the fireplace. Well, and you'll see this in scriptures, guys. This is the king priest that set up the city. We get a type and shadow of this in scripture. Do you remember the first king priest we get? Melchizedek. So he was responsible for setting up the hearth. Now, this hearth was the you know what the Latin word for that is? Altar. Wow. So he's the guy responsible because it's all based on worship, all of it. So he would set up the hearth of the city. Now, the king, there's so much imagery here. The king, he didn't marry individuals. The king was said to marry the city. You guys are looking at me like I'm crazy again. Now, how would he marry the city? Well, he would come in and spend the night in the city. Let me ask you a question. How many nights did Jesus spend in Jerusalem? Anybody? See, you guys don't even ask these questions, do you? He never stayed all night in Jerusalem. Do you think there was symbolic there? He always went out of the city. Why is he always going out of the city? When the day is done, he heads up to Bethany, stay at Lazarus' house. Worst case scenario, he goes and stays in the Gethsemane, in the Garden of Olives. Never. Because they knew this typology that if he slept in that city, then he becomes married to the city. And he's the king, but see, he doesn't. But where is he crucified? Where does he spend the night? In the tomb. See, in the tomb is this imagery that we'll look at it here in a few minutes of wedding. It has these both things. The first wedding took place over in the garden when Adam is put to sleep. See, everything is opposite of the way we think. We think the day starts in the morning with the rising sun. But in the scriptures, the day starts at 6 p.m. Now, the king would set up the hearth. And isn't it funny how, you know, that when people get married today, they stand in front of that very thing. We call it, what, an arbor or whatever. But it's the same thing. You're coming before that altar. Now, in the book of Judges, remember, that's where they would set their gods, on that hearth. You remember Rachel stole the gods, and she's sitting on them and said, I can't get up, when she stole them. And they take them out and bury them under the oak tree. See, all of those things are there in the scriptures, but you're asking about the Vestal Virgins. They had seven Vestal Virgins, and the Vestal Virgins were in charge of keeping the fires burning on the altar. Now, what was the priest to do in Jerusalem? God had set them up to keep the fires burning in the candlestick. Rome had the same thing. That was called Vestal Virgins. Well, see, Paul is writing to Corinthians, and he couldn't talk to them about the priestly duties, right? Because they don't know about the priestly duties. They'd never been in the tabernacle before, never been in Solomon's temple, not even allowed to look in there. So Paul uses language that they can understand, and he says, present you as a chaste virgin. They got it all. We'll be keepers of the flame for the city. So see, when he marries, he's not marrying individuals, he's marrying the city. And now what is the city called? New Jerusalem. Now see, Paul uses this language in Galatians, because Rome used this kind of language that she was the mother. And as they conquered other cities, then they became mother to that city. Now, Paul uses this language in Galatians, and he says, Jerusalem above is free and what? The mother of us all. He's using the same language. When you hear these things, and see, when you begin to understand a little bit of history and see how rich and vibrant it is, man, it's mind-blowing to me. I don't know if it is to you or not, but golly. So when Jesus tells these stories, these parables, and I've heard people say this, oh my gosh, he told them parables because he didn't want them to know. Let me tell you something. If there's something I don't want Teddy to know, guess what? I'm not going to tell him. I'm not going to say a word. Are you? I'm not going to say, Teddy, I know a secret, and you don't know, and I'm going to tell you the secret has something to do with shoes and a shoestring, but I can't tell you because you're not part of the call. That's really stupid, isn't it? I would just not tell him. So Jesus is telling these parables and telling us these stories, and every one, I don't know, when you read, there's a doorway, there's an invitation for that story, for you to come into that story. My God, you think, well, I don't understand. Just ask, well, why is Esau tired? God, you got to tell me. I don't know. The story's incomplete in the King James Bible because he doesn't tell us. Why don't you tell us? Because it's a doorway inviting you in to come in and see. Come and see. Isn't that what he says? Come and see. Come on, John. He's inviting all of us. Come and see. Golly, writing these stories and reading these stories is fun. So many doorways. And you know what? Jesus is the door. And he's inviting us in, into the story. Guys, we have, I'll just share some with you. We have these same things going on in our culture today. When I talk about, okay, everybody knows the story of Pinocchio, right? What do y'all know about Pinocchio? It's a liar, right? That's our focus point on Pinocchio. Pinocchio, the little wooden boy. Oh, that's for little kids, isn't it? Isn't it amazing an adult wrote it? Isn't it amazing that the little boy wanted to become real? Isn't it amazing that Pinocchio gets swallowed by a fish? Did you guys remember that part? Does this sound familiar? I wonder where this fish imagery come from. Some things that happened to him while he's inside of the fish. Here's a question. I'm going to see how good you guys are. What was Pinocchio's helper's name? Not Geppetto. The little one that was with him all the time helping him. Jimmy the Cricket. What's the initials for Jimmy the Cricket? Jesus Christ. I mean, we look at these things and we don't get it, but I mean, C.S. Lewis is taking these stories and he's Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and he's drawing us into these stories. And you know, we get so stoic, oh, we can't read, we can't, you know, have any of this. When Paul is quoting their own poets to him, when Paul says, present you as a chaste virgin, he's saying, present you as a vestal virgin to the Lord Jesus, who's the real king of the city. They understood that language. Right? Peter Pan. Again, Peter Pan. He's dealing with Captain Hook. You remember Captain Hook lost his arm to an alligator, and the alligator has inside of him, you know what he's got inside of him? A clock. Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. I mean, these stories, guys, they just go on and on. Some of them we can see them so plain in, like, The Lion King. Those are great stories, and sometimes the writers don't even know what they're writing, but here they are, and they're just, so see, we as storytellers, what Paul learned to do is go in there with Jesus into those stories, and he said, oh man, let me tell you something. You talk about a lion, let me tell you about a lion, right? See, in that story, those stories connect us also. God sends Paul to Arabia to learn about Gentile people. And you think, well, God would never do that. My Lord, he did it starting out with Moses. What did he do with Moses? Stuck him right in Pharaoh's house. Why? I mean, you know, we got to learn to talk about those things. So anyway, in these verses here, coming off of the rich fool here, building barns and all of that, and Jesus is following this up. He's about to contrast the fool's fast attempts at living well with the behavior of crows and lilies and grass creatures. Who just unknowingly trust in God for their life. You know, one of the things I was thinking of this morning, I come out and this is kind of on my mind, and we'll say these terms, but then I got to go back and I got to look. Paul would tell these Gentiles, put ye on Christ. Now, what do we do with that? We're sitting here trying to figure out, my God, how do we put on Christ? And we come up with all kinds of things, but I want you to know this was a language that they would have understood. They would have just, oh, so they're trying to put on something, but what is it they're trying to put on here that Paul is contrasting with put on Christ? Because I know what we'll do. Over here in our crazy Western culture, people will get up in the morning and they'll like go to the closet and take Jesus out of the closet and put him on. I put Jesus on, and then, you know, then I covered him up with my other shirt. No, wait a minute, Jesus is the outer shirt and I'm the t-shirt. And, you know, we just go through all kinds of stupid stuff here. But so you got to go back and you got to look what language is Paul contrasting there. And then when you see it, You can take it all the way back to Genesis and find out some culture stuff, because you remember, as soon as Adam and Eve, they messed up, what did God do? God clothed them with what? Skins. Wow. I wonder where this language kind of comes from. And you might think this is just pagan language, but or Jewish language, but remember who wrote Genesis? Anybody know who wrote the book of Genesis? Moses. You guys are looking at me with long faces today. I hope I didn't rock you with the 7-day Holy Week thing. You guys are kind of looking at me like, he's kind of crazy today. So you would think that God would have had some scribes right there in the garden writing everything down, but Moses doesn't write the book of Genesis for about 2,000 years after Genesis happened. So when he's starting to write down about the value of the gold found in the river and the bdellium and all that, who gave it value? Who said gold is going to be worth some money? Because it was just floating around out there. And Adam and Eve, they didn't look down and say, oh my God, we're in a rich place. They didn't know what rich was, right? They didn't know what poor was. They had no idea. So somewhere along the line, somebody had to give value to gold. And out of that value that was given to gold, then God begins to use a system here to tell them a story. Okay, well, I'm going to talk to you about glory, and I'm going to use gold and put it in the temple and make it do all of this other stuff. So here he says in Luke 12, verse 22, and he said to his disciples, therefore is coming off the fact that this rich fool here was wanting to build bigger barns and all of this other stuff. And he says, therefore, I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat, neither for the body what ye shall put on. Life is more than meat, and the body's more than raiment. Consider the ravens. Consider the crows. Now, God is telling us to go consider the crows. What a dumb thing to say. Do you ever think about that? Do you ever see a crow and remember the Lord's words? Come on, man. Maybe I'll jump up and do some exercise here and get everybody's attention here. Do you see a crow and say, God has told me to look at that crow? There's a lesson there. And he said, every crow you see is a doorway. Ah, but it's a dark door. But he says, come in. But we're afraid of what's in there. He says, consider the crows. Watch them. They don't sow. They don't reap. They don't have storehouse nor barn. And God feedeth them. How much more are ye better than the fowls, than the crows? And which of you, taking thought, can add to his stature one cubit? Isn't that something? If ye then be not able to do that thing which is least, why take ye thought for the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They toil not, spin not, and yet I say unto you that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. You see, guys, what is it? I mean, you got to understand. What is it that people all their life live in fear of? All their life, people live in fear of death. Sometimes we see it more so than others, but everybody lives in fear of death. Oh my God. I mean, whether it's we're scared of spiders. Why? Because they're ugly and creepy? No, because a spider might die or might bite us and then inject us with some poison and our head explode. Right? Some fly may get on us and lay larvae in us and we turn into the fly. Well, there's movies about this stuff, right? So we live our whole life. It's the root of greed. And that's what he had just contrasted there with this guy in the storehouse. It was about greed, because now I'm not trusting God to provide for me. I got to provide for myself. So I need more and I need more. And you know what? The eye is never full. It's always going, always going, always going. It's never enough. How much is enough? 10 million, 100 million, 100 billion? How much is enough? It's never enough. It's never enough. Even read where Walt Disney had himself frozen. Y'all remember that? Cryogenics. afraid of death. And this whole time, Jesus is inviting us to the one place that is safe, that nobody can take from you. Ye are dead. So when Paul says these languages, you are dead and your life is hid with Christ in God. My gosh, this is, we're like, oh, there's treasures up in the sky. And we got, well, if that's the way you understand it, but there is a place, there is a rest left unto the people of God. Because remember, we talked about this last week, Solomon in all of his glory. What was Solomon's glory? It was the way he lived. But one is greater here than Solomon. And what is that way that Jesus lived? He died. That was greater. That's just opposite. I told you, it's just opposite of everything that we think, because our whole world is built upon selfishness, exaltation. Jesus says, hey guys, when you come into the synagogue, what seat do you get? Take the lower seats. Least some more honorable man come in and you be stuck to the back, but then you get invited up. But see, we come in and it's all, we want the biggest, we want the best. We see that today. I mean, you know, I'm part of a, you know, I'm one of what they call on the railroad an old head. You know, the guys that I always ask, what did y'all used to do? That's when you're getting old. But you know how it is, and we say, well, this new generation. You know what? I was part of the new generation. Nobody likes the new generation. I always do things different than the old generation. And now I'm one of the old generations. You know what? The new generation does stupid stuff again, just like I used to do. You see, the same circle goes on and on and on. But one of the things is with the new generation, they're just like the old generation. They want to be the CEO of the company within 3 weeks. Right? Isn't that the way it goes? It's one of two ways. Either the people go to work and complain about the work that they have to do and how many days off a week do I get? Or when am I going to be owner of this company? I mean, I've been here at work 6 hours now. They ain't promoted me yet. The sphere of death. Solomon in all of his glory. Remember, that's going to take us right back to Jonah. Remember, no sign given but the sign of Jonah. Then he says in verse 28, if then God so clothed the grass, which is today in the field, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, how much more will he clothe ye, O ye of little faith? Now, why would he make this statement here? You know, if God so clothed the grass, which is today in the field and tomorrow is cast into the oven. I mean, this kind of language. But I mean, I don't even know how to say it sometimes. But, you know, we forget this point. Because, I think sometimes, man, why? Why death? And what do we do with death as Christians? Oh, well, they got saved. They got, you know, they didn't get saved. Whatever. We talk about stupid stuff. But right here is kind of in this language here. Oh, ye of little faith. But look, the grass, which is today in the field, tomorrow is cast and is burned up by the sun. You know, he's trying to remind us again how short, in one sense, and how precious life is. The thing that we've been talking about, and the church, God help them, has been robbing people of the importance of your daily lives. It's so important in your daily lives every day, and not so you can go to heaven. I believe in heaven. Don't mishear me. I believe in heaven. My mama is there, okay? But our whole emphasis is now. This is where we are. And we're to be full of joy and goodness and all of these things every single day. He says, because look, you guys get one chance at this. So death every time ought to be a reminder to us, my God, what are you doing? You don't have time to be depressed. And you know what? It comes knocking on us. Loneliness comes knocking on us. All these stupid things comes knocking on the door. And we ought to tell every one of them, nobody's home. We don't have time for this stuff. And we're told to consider the crows. Consider the lilies. Consider the grass. All of these other things. But you know, we're scared all the time of death, of death, of death. That's the one thing that Jesus is going to go to take the sting out, to take the fear out of it. So then I can live my life. And if something happens in my life and it costs me my life, oh well. I tell you, I look at people and I wish the church could imitate them just a little bit more. And these, I call them crazy people, but they're risk takers. You know, they get in airplanes and jump out with a little piece of cloth on their back. And I think, you guys are crazy. But they're risk takers. And every day, God is inviting us into this taking the risk of laying our lives down. Take the risk of forgiveness. It doesn't matter if your reputation is shot. It doesn't matter if they owe you. You can take the risk. Oh, my God, if I let that go. We got to stand. We got to draw the line. We got to stand. And he says, take the risk and don't stand. Take the risk. See, it sounds opposite. In one place it's stand, contend for the faith. And in another one it says, lay your life down. Well, maybe that is the faith that we're to stand for. And we stand by laying our life down one for another. Guys, that's the only thing that's going to bring salvation and extend the kingdom of heaven. Nothing else is going to do it. Good sermons ain't going to do it, guys. I promise you they're not. If so, Billy Graham could have saved the world. He couldn't. All these movements, George Whitefield, my God, George Whitefield, when he preached in Philadelphia, 32,000 people showed up. Everybody in the city showed up to, can you imagine that? And this dude would stand on a bucket and preach. You guys ever heard of George Whitefield? Verse 29, and seek not what ye shall eat, what ye shall drink, neither be ye of doubtful mind, for all those things do the nations of the world seek after, and your Father knoweth that ye have need of those things. But rather seek ye the kingdom of God. And all these things shall be added unto you. Fear not, little flock. Fear not. Now look at this. Because they're afraid. Why would he say fear not? Because they're afraid. Everybody's afraid. Oh my God. Fear not, little flock. Verse 32. And look how it reads. For the Father despises and will never give you the kingdom until you earn it. Wrong? You guys ought to be jumping up and down here. Look at this. I mean, we think, oh, God with the long stoic face, it's his good pleasure. What makes God happy? I thought I went out and I did some good work. Boy, God said, man, I'm just so proud of him. Whoa, man, no. It's his good pleasure to give. Well, I don't deserve it. No, I'll wait till I earn it. Come on. It's his good pleasure to give you the kingdom. What is the kingdom? Righteousness, peace, joy, and the Holy Spirit. My God, his desire to give that to us. And man, I'm telling you what, them, I want to say some words here, but I want, they have ruined the adventure because they have made the Holy Spirit some kind of tyrannical possessing demon that gets a hold of you and makes you roll through the floor. And the Holy Spirit is the joy between the Father and the Son. It's, as Malcolm says, and Malcolm didn't coin the phrase, but it's been out there, it's the dance. Now, does dance sound like something that makes you, you know, when I'm dancing and I'm rolling in the floor, that's because I done pulled a muscle, twisted my ankle real bad. I guess if you break dancing, you might waller in the floor. They look like they're having a lot of fun. See, we've made the Holy Spirit. Everything it's not, the Holy Spirit is joy. My goodness. And it's the Father's good pleasure to give you that. And then what does he say? Sell that ye have and give alms. Provide yourselves bags which wax not old. Now, boy, what kind of statement is that? How are you going to? I mean, some people, I mean, Tracy and I were Christmas shopping, and there was some pocketbooks down there at the Belk, and she said, oh, come here and look at the price of these pocketbooks. Good gosh. What kind of was them, baby? Them pocketbooks. Who? No, they was a step up. Louis Vuitton. Oh, yeah, Louis Vuitton. I don't know who this Louis Vuitton is, but I'm just wondering when people's going to be buying the Jim Moore pocketbooks. Yeah. They might look like a Walmart bag, but I will take a Sharpie and write my name on them. Just don't put much in them or they'll split out. You might have to double bag it. What kind of bags are you going to get here? What's wax not old? I mean, come on here. I will tell you, our death is the one bag that'll never wear out. The true treasure in heaven that will never decrease. Our death is the one thing, the only thing the world can ever take away from us. Everything else, they can take. I mean, technically speaking, you don't own nothing. You might think you got the title to it, but you don't own it. Old Mr. Big G owns everything in this place, and he can take it at a moment's notice. But he can't take that away from you. You're dead, and your life is hid with Christ and God. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. See, we read these things and we kind of get these Alibaba kind of things in our mind, treasures up in heaven and all of these things. But man, and then he tells this watchful servants here. Because he's coming right off of saying all that. Let your loins be girded about and your lights burning. And ye yourselves liken to men that wait for their Lord, and when he will return from the wedding, that when he cometh and knocketh, they may open unto him immediately. Now see, we always sectionalize these things. Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you, he shall gird himself and make them sit down to meat and will come forth and serve them. What do people understand when they read that? You know what the American church is? Oh, the Lord's coming back, and when he does, and then you'll go to heaven, you'll be with him up in heaven eating at his big dinner table. But is this the whole thing that he's talking about? He's just talking about crows. So that must mean heaven's going to be full of crows and lilies and grasshoppers. He just mentioned it. And then he says, therefore, here's the watchful servants. What he's telling here is his disciples, and I'll get to this point here in a minute. He's telling his disciples here, man, Peter and John and James and Matthew, you guys has got an incredibly joyful piece of understanding to impart to the desperate winners out there who are spending their life in fear, who are scared to death at the thought of losing. I can remember, guys, I know what it's like because I have lost stuff. And you know what I realize when I have lost? And you know what? I didn't even lose it. They come and got it. I knew right where it was. And they got it, Teddy. Something about you don't make a payment. You know what I mean? I knew where it was. And then in that whole thing, it's like, oh, my God. And we're taught. And I'm not saying we got to be stupid here, but it's like, oh, my God, you got to keep your credit. Oh, what happens if your credit ain't good? See, we kind of bring over all of this. We got to have a good credit at the bank. You got to have good credit with God. Well, guess what? You might lose them both. Oh, can you? But see, this is that thing. Oh, my God, I sinned today. I lost my credit with God. You know, and I got to keep up with that. So they're spending their whole lives in this sphere. And he's telling his disciples, man, you guys have got some incredibly valuable information here. And what he's telling his disciples here is, guys, I don't want you stumbling around in their darkness with your pants down, the pants of your trust down for lack of girding the loins of faith in my death. Kind of sound like what Paul is going to say in Ephesians. And he opens the parable with an even more pregnant bit of imagery here. With stuck right in the middle of there's a wedding. Why would he use a wedding? But it's stuck right there. In verse 36. Do you ever ask why would he put that in there? Oh my gosh. What do y'all think of when you think of wedding? I mean, honestly, the first thoughts that come to your mind, what do you think of? Not the money it cost. But anything, oh my God, I'm glad I only got $2. I know some people that had 12. Oh my God, what are they going to do? They all get married in a barn. But what do you think of? This joyous time, right? The joyous time. Festivities. Happiness. I mean, when you're thinking of a wedding here, do you immediately think, oh my God, judgment, white throne, oh my God, this is terrible. Immediately, or something ought to jump off the page to us right here. He didn't say, oh my God, when Jesus is coming back, he's coming back on a white horse, on a white throne, it's going to be judgment. He throws the imagery of wedding in here. He's just told us, fear not, because he knows how our hearts are always thinking, oh, my God, God is going to get us. And he says, stop it, guys. Let me bring this imagery around here of wedding. See, I know this may sound contrary here because we don't kind of like this because it butts up against everything we've been taught. Everything we've been taught, be scared, be terrified. You know, God is out to kill people. I just showed you the verse that says it's his good pleasure to give you the kingdom. You know, I don't think naturally sometimes in my mind, you know, people say, well, you know, God doesn't send anybody to hell. You do that yourself. And I just think in my own mind sometimes, you know, when my kids, even though sometimes I want to wring their necks, there's never a time in my life, and you being evil know how to get a good guess where I'm going to draw the line in the sand and say, well, that's it. I hate to, Zach, but I'm going to have to take you out back. Get my 30-06. That's it. I'm just going to have to end it right here. I'm done. I mean, would that ever happen? No. Might beat them with it. That's okay. Boy, there goes my video for the day. Shut down again. Mark the time, baby. I guarantee it'll be your video has been. Yeah. Well, guys, I want to bring us back here and just pause a second and think, man, what are we doing? What's this wedding doing in this parable? Because when we're talking about watching for the Lord, we're thinking second coming, we're thinking all of this go to heaven when you die stuff. Guys, this isn't the language he's talking about, is it? This isn't the language. Consider the crows, consider the lilies, consider the grass, treasures, you know, all of this stuff. And now, be watchful. But let me illustrate something here because he mentions when he will return from the wedding. So the first image that we're going to get of a marriage, just a couple I'm going to throw out, is the marriage of Cana. Jesus, when he did his first miracle, his first sign, and what did he do in that? He turned the water into wine. And what were they doing? They were having a great party. They were having a blast. 180 gallons of wine at that party. And then in Revelation 19 and Revelation 21, the marriage of the Lamb to his bride, the New Jerusalem. We talked about that a little earlier. These two passages in which a wedding reception is used to portray major events in history, Jesus' first miracle, the marriage of marrying the whole city. It makes me suspicious of just overlooking this event here, of there being a wedding stuck in here. This is something of great detail, of great importance. Had Jesus simply wanted to make the Lord of the servants late, why not just have him hung up in traffic somewhere? Why not have him over to a friend's house? You know. But Jesus says precisely it's when he will return from the wedding. What are we going to do? So if we take the doctrine as it's preached to us today, Jesus is already married. So if he's already married to his people, then who is he coming back for? Because you're his people. Yeah, I mean, you understand here, this imagery just doesn't match up. So if he's coming back to take you to the wedding, wait a minute. If this is about Jesus' second return, then you missed the wedding. Right? I mean, see, when you hear all of this crazy stuff, just remember these little verses like this and say, no, wait a minute. This doesn't add up here. Because he's returning from the wedding. Most people don't even think about it, or just boom, they got it. He uses this language here of wedding because in weddings, there's a connection between weddings and death. You know, two things happen at the same time. You know, Hannah and Jake, they got married. So as the two become one, but you know what that also means? That means Jake is dead. And you think, well, Jake ain't dead. That means Jake is dead to every other woman on the face of the planet. Hannah, as much as she is alive to Jake, she is dead to every other man on the face of the planet. And that's it. Dead. So when we kind of see the imageries of the two becoming alive, but at the same time the two becoming dead. So the marriage here is a death and a resurrection all at the same time. It's two here. We look at things with one and say, well, no, but this is the image. I mean, consider the wedding in Cana. First, when Jesus' mother tells him at the party, hey, man, we're out of wine. Jesus kind of responds kind of crazy here. Let me go read it in John chapter 2. I always thought he was kind of being a smart aleck to his mom. And Jesus says, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet. What kind of language is that? What hour? Is he looking at the clock? So, man, it's only 3. I don't bring in the new wine until about 8:45. What is he talking about when he says mine hour? Does anybody know? His cross, his passion, mine hour. So he is associating right there with a wedding his passion, his cross. He's bringing the two together. Mine hour. You see that? And also the time sequence of John, right after Cana, or right after this wedding at Cana, he comes in and cleanses out the temple, in which all the other gospels don't tell us he didn't do that till Holy Week. And when Jesus is turning out the money changers, he says this. He makes a reference to his death. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. But he spake of the temple of his body. And as for the second passage, the marriage of the Lamb to his bride in Revelation is equally pointing to and filled with this imagery of death. Notice the Lamb in the book of Revelation. What kind of Lamb is it? Anybody know what kind of Lamb it is? A slain Lamb. I remember J.W. asking, what in the world is a slain Lamb doing here? Yeah, this Lamb is slain. This Lamb is, goodness. The citizens of the New Jerusalem that come down from heaven as a bride prepared for her husband, they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Does anybody not ask dumb questions like me and say, look, I don't take my whites and wash them in blood and expect them to come out pristine. That's kind of dumb, isn't it? So, if those two passages weren't enough importing of death into this imagery of marriage, then go back and read. I won't go there. The king's son's wedding in Matthew 22, 1 through 14. And when death is poured all over the thing. I mean, he goes out and invites everybody. Let me just go over and show you a verse or two of it. Matthew 22. The king of heaven is likened to a certain king which made a marriage for his son. He sent forth his servants, bid everybody to come to the wedding. And they wouldn't come. They made light of it. Went their way, one to his farm, another to his merchandise. And the remnant took his servants and entreated them spitefully and slew them, killed the servants. But when the king heard of it, he was wroth and sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up the city. Wow, a little bit of retribution here, isn't it? I'm sending you my servants, inviting you to the party. You don't want to come to the party, and you kill my servants. I'm going to your house, and we're going to burn everything down. Woo, that's some rough language right there. But those come under the parables of judgment, because when Jesus says that, the rival king has showed up into the city. It's Matthew 22. But back to Luke, keeping in mind there's a wedding, let your mind play with these spiritual parallels. The Lord of the servants here is who? It's Jesus back in Luke. The Lord of the servants is Jesus. And in this parable, back here in Luke, he comes to him from where? A wedding feast. Correspondingly in Revelation, he comes from a wedding feast. He comes to the consummation of history from his own wedding nuptials in the slain lamb. Wedding nuptials. Man, there is so much imagery here. Oh my gosh, it is just mind-blowing. And the servants here, to take another parallel, are described as waiting expectantly to open to the Lord when he knocks. We, their counterparts, are to be ready to welcome the slain lamb when he stands at the door and knocks. Now, why is Jesus standing at the door and knocking? Next Sunday, I'm taking out all the chairs. That's it, I'm taking out all the chairs. Why does he stand at the door and knock? He wants to come in and eat dinner with you. Finally, when the Lord comes and finds his servants watching, they are blessed because he will gird himself with a towel and come in and dine with them and wash them. And wow. And what does he say? I mean, the king has come. I mean, there's so much imagery. This is Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, guess what? I'm having dinner at your house today. The king is coming. And you know what? We're the servants here waiting on the Lord. And, oh, not waiting on him to come back in the sky somewhere. Now, this whole thing waiting, he's knocking at the door. He will knock and he will come in and he brings the party with him. This is party language here. The imagery of the coming of the Lord in this parable is party, celebration imagery. Jesus comes to us from a party and he brings the party with him. Oh my gosh, you guys, sleeping during the party. Jesus finds a lost sheep, what's he do? Oh my God, this sheep is so stinking heavy, smelly. God, it's been in the briars, its tail's all full of cockle burrs, and I'm just stinking dumb sheep, and I've walked, my feet are sore. What does he do, guys? Yeah, but when he gets back, what does he do? He has a party. And I'm telling you, Jesus likes parties. He likes parties. We get too religious. Oh, you know, we just stand at attention. And he's made it clear that he will keep the party going both now and forever. Guys, I'm not doing away with the other side. Okay, I don't want you to think that for 1 second. I believe with all my heart that we will see Jesus. Our eyes will behold him and not the eyes of another. But this Bible is about today and now and how that you and I can live our lives in the freedom from the fear of death. And see, we do this in this mystery of the Lord's Supper, which we celebrate. And what's it say? You do show forth the Lord's death until he come. Revelation 19:9 says, blessed or happy are those that come to the supper, the marriage supper of the Lamb, where we sit together with him in heavenly places as his bride. The Bible is so full of this imagery. I mean, you could kind of sum it up in this one way. Real simple here. Everybody wants a catchphrase. Here's the Bible. Boy meets girl. Boy loses girl. Boy gets girl. Wow. That's the story of creation. I just told you the story of creation. And you said, well, how's that? Well, let me just do it this way. The Word, who in response to the Father's good pleasure, woos creation into being out of nothing. Woos it into being. Meets the world in the first couple of chapters of Genesis, falls in head over heels in love with it. But in chapter 3, the world turns its back on the Word and wanders in lostness and death. Then, in most of the rest of the scriptures, the Word unceasingly seeks in death for the beloved that he lost. He seeks for her in the passion and the defeat of Israel in the Old Testament when they're swept away into Babylon. And in the death of the incarnate Lord of the New. And finally, in Revelation, by his attracting and winsome power as the slain lamb, the Word courts the world once and for all. And at the end of the story, boy gets girl, marries her, takes her home to his father's house. And they live happily ever after. Wow. It's a consummation worth waiting for. It's this joyful safeness of that waiting that is principal burden of the parable of the watchful servants. And he tells the story, even if the Lord of the servants comes at midnight or later, they are blessed because his will is only to come and sup with them. So as this parable applies to us, no one who waits on Jesus in faith can ever wait too long. Kind of sounds like old Isaiah, don't it? Those that wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. And we're never in danger of missing him. Only when we go off to try to gain life by some other means do we miss him and the party. And I'm gonna stop here, Jeff. If you want to come on, because before I get into the other part of this, because he's just told us that our life does not consist in the abundance of things. Remember, all of this is in contrast. We got to keep all of this together. But our life, again, is hid with Christ in God in the mystery of Jesus' death and resurrection. He that loses his life shall find it. Now, and verse 41, then Peter said unto him, Lord, are you speaking this parable to us or to everybody? And you know what Jesus does? You know how Jesus answers him? With another stinking parable. You would think he would just say, yeah, nope, whatever. But he says, who then is a faithful and wise steward whom his Lord shall make ruler over his household to give them their portion of meat in due season? Now remember, as we go looking for this, we're going to see beaten and we're going to see all of this other stuff. But what is the principal thing here that the Lord is doing, is coming from? A wedding. We lose sight of that, and man, we miss out on the beauty of the whole thing. There's little details right there in those stories that just make, you know, that's what makes a good writer, a good storyteller, when they can bring you into the story and you can smell the lilies by the way they describe it. Guys, I'm telling you what, we need to get back into good storytelling. We really, really do, because this is a great story. And you know what? Everybody's involved in the story. And these stories all interconnect and they intertwine and they just, wow. Guys, those are the things that draw us together. All the things that our country tries to tell us and all of this, they don't drive us together. All they do is drive us apart. But Jesus will even be talking about that. In a few verses, he's going to say, I come to bring division and not peace. I come to set the world on fire. I wonder what he means by that. I'm going to tell you what. It's the same language of death and resurrection. Same language he's using. Weddings, death, and resurrection. That's what it is. Anyway, guys, I better quit with that.